At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE. Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts, and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. We start by looking at the bestseller lists on Amazon.co.uk and the Sunday Times, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK. Only a few new entries this week. Then we'll be catching up with Guy Lloyd, the international sales manager at Penguin Random House. He joins us once a month to talk all things books. Among other things, this month he's talking about why there is a resurgence in the classics and what makes a classic. We also talk about the sad passing of Gilly Cooper and the recently awarded Nobel Prize for Literature. We're also chatting to Projector Kohli, who's one of India's most loved and successful digital content creators, with over 18 million followers across social media platforms. As an actor, Projector is best known for her lead role in Netflix's Mismatched. She is featured in both GQ India and The Hollywood Reporter's Most Influential Indians list. She's also featured in Michelle Obama's daytime Emmy-winning docu-series promoting girls' education. Her debut novel, Too Good to Be True, is the sparkling, true blue, will they, won't they love story you've been waiting for. Finally, we're chatting to Triliana Pucci. She's a best-selling romance author with a twist, often blending genres with her signature romantic comedies. One Killer Night combines romance, comedy, and psychological suspense to create an unputdownable read that is both hilarious and dark. It's set on the night of Halloween. That's just the first hour. In the second hour, we continue with a bit of a Halloween theme, chatting to Victor Wind, Marilyn Horowitz, and Kristin Lush.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
The pen's in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate.
Good evening. Welcome to The Book Show. We start by looking at the Sunday Times bestseller list, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK. This is the one that every author wants to be on. The chart is the most accurate and comprehensive estimation of book sales in the country. The path to Christmas number one is narrowing and positions are beginning to solidify. The number ones across the four main categories are the same as last week, which hasn't happened since February. While Charlie Mackesy is still still ruling the roost. It's been a great week for Freda McFadden, who has three novels in the charts. Even more astonishing, two of them have been published in the last 3 months. So let's have a look at general hardbacks. Just three new entries from last week. At number one, Always Remember by Charlie Mackesy. Number two, When Gavin Met Stacey and Everything in Between by Ruth Jones and James Corden. Number three, The Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins and Sawyer Robbins. Number four, Last Rites by Ozzy Osbourne. Number five, The Boy, The Mole, The Fox and The Horse by Charlie Mackesy. Number six is a new entry called Pomp and Circumstance by Penny Mordaunt and Chris Lewis. It's an exploration of Britain's traditions from ancient to new, national and local. Number seven is Freddie Flintoff, Coming Home by Andrew Flintoff. Number eight, What Have I Done by Ben Elton. Number nine, a new entry by Tim Spector. It's called Ferment, and it's all about the science behind fermented food and the role of microbes in our gut health. Number 10 is a new entry called Vagabond by Tim Curry, a behind-the-scenes story of the actor's greatest roles on stage and screen. Looking at fiction hardbacks, just two new entries from last week. At number one, The Impossible Fortune by Richard Osman. Number two, The Secret of Secrets by Dan Brown. Number three, The Long Shoe by Bob Mortimer. Number four, a new entry called Savage Blooms by S.T. Gibson. Two travellers become trapped in a manor and face ancient magic and hidden desires. Number five, The Killing Stones by Anne Cleves. Number six, Alchemized by Sen Lin Yu. Number seven, Berlin Trailer by Philippa Gregory. Number eight, the other new entry, Daughter of No Worlds by Carissa Broadbent, seeking to save her friend, a woman apprentices with a reclusive fire wielder. Number nine, Alchemy of Secrets by Stephanie Garber. And number 10 is No Regret by Martina Cole and Jackie Rose. Moving on to Amazon.co.uk and the top 10 bestsellers for this week. At number one is Nobody's Girl, a memoir of surviving abuse and fighting for justice by Virginia Roberts Gouffre. Number two, A Mind of My Own by Kathy Burke. Number three, The Rose Field, which is book three in the Book of Dust series by Philip Pullman. Number four, Always Remember, The Boy, The Mole, The Fox, The Horse and The Storm by Charlie Mackesy. Number five, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Party Pooper. That's number 20 in the series by Jeff Kinney. The Impossible Fortune, number five in the Thursday Murder Club series by Richard Osman. Number seven is The Housemaid by Freda McFadden. Number eight, The Hawk is Dead. That's number 21 in the Roy Grace series by Peter James. Number nine, Bored of Lunch, Healthy Fakeaways by Nathan Anthony. And number 10, yep, you're still colouring in, Cozy Corner, a calm and comforting colouring book for all ages by Coco Wyo.
A book programme presented by Hannah Murray.
You're listening to The Book Club on Talk Radio Europe. And keep listening. That's an instruction from Margaret Thatcher.
Joining us on the line now is Guy Lloyd. He's the International Sales Manager for Penguin Random House and joins us once a month to talk all things books. How are you, Guy?
Very well indeed, Hannah, and relieved to have got another Frankfurt Book Fair out of the way. I got back about 11:15 last night, so yeah.
Oh, amazing.
It's over. It's still going on, but it's as busy as ever.
How did it go? Why are you glad to get it out the way? Is it quite stressful?
Well, it's just a bit full on. And also, I mean, I did a piece on the Frankfurt Fair last year, and I explained that it is about four or five times the size of Olympia, where the London Book Fair is.
Gosh.
And for those people who know London and have been to Olympia, they'll know what a massive trade hall that is. It's two trade halls, and there are 9 or 10 at Frankfurt, most of which are used for the book fair, and it is just cramped. I mean, each hall has more than one floor, so altogether there are, you know, a couple of dozen floors, literally hundreds of thousands of people, and particularly on the first couple of days, it's packed corridors. You need to queue for quite a lot of things. I'm mostly nailed to the stand with back-to-back meetings, but it was productive, but it's tiring.
Yeah, and it's trade, isn't it? So you're meeting what other publishers and agents Absolutely. And things.
Yeah, they do have a public day. They allow the German public in at the weekends, which has its interesting challenge. Most people in the trade try and do all their meetings and be gone by then,
right?
Including me, because bless them, nothing wrong with the German public. But I think there is a tendency to think that just because you've paid an entrance fee to get in, that all the books on the stand are free, which we politely have to explain in my fragmented German that they aren't, which I have done in years gone by.
Yeah.
That's always a bit bit diplomatic.
Mm-hmm. And authors there as well. There's an author who I follow on Instagram who I've interviewed a few times over the years, Matt Dunn, and he posted a video up at the fair with a poster of his latest book on display. And I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Well, there are lots of events. I mean, there are authors who appear there, but as you walk around all the stands in the fair, sometimes you'll walk past a stand and there'll be a group of people, there'll be a microphone, and the stand will be set up like a little platform with, and it could be a talk on anything from, you know, the role of AI in book publishing to an author talking about their book. But yes, there is, it's not just the likes of the publishing chattering classes like me doing business. There are things to see and people to listen to as well.
Yeah, interesting. And one of the things we're going to talk about today is the classics and why there's a resurgence in the classics.
Well, there has been quite recently, and I think it's helpful maybe to discuss about what is a classic, because everybody thinks they know what a classic is. We all know, right? But everyone's idea is different.
Mm.
And in fact, the concept of a classic is changing all the time because times change and fashions change. And there are quite a lot of best-selling authors now who I bet no one will ever have heard of in 100 years. And the same is true now of authors who were really huge bestsellers decades ago. So people like Elizabeth Daly, J.G. Farrell, who won the Booker Prize in 1973, who no one knows now. Children's authors like Frank Richards, who was the creator of Billy Bunter. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Billy Bunter, they're an increasingly dated series of books featuring a group of English public schoolboys who were always getting hampers from maiden aunts and getting into frightful scrapes, that sort of thing. But it's very, very dated now. So no one's read Frank Richards for years, but he was a huge, huge bestseller in his day. So it's not necessarily the bestsellers that make a classic. So maybe it's a classic because we're taught it's a classic. And until around the 1960s, if you studied English literature at Oxbridge, you followed a pretty fixed line of classic teaching. You started with Beowulf, which is sort of the original long-form Anglo-Saxon poem. You went through Chaucer, Shakespeare, Milton. Then you went into the 18th and 19th century classics, George Eliot, Dickens, etc. And then it stopped because the lecturers, even up to about the 1960s, didn't yet consider 20th century literature as classic or even worth teaching. It was a bit too modern. And then gradually, because the 60s were a bit more progressive, the likes of D.H. Lawrence started appearing, and then the modernists from the 20s like T.S. Eliot. But they haven't always been thought of as classics, so time clearly plays a part here. There is a theory that a classic is a classic because a publisher tells you it's a classic. And one of the Penguin divisions this year launched something called the Mermaid Collection, and they launched it very much as a classic series. And it's a list of, quote, unjustly neglected novels, unquote, written by women in the second half of the 20th century. Now, some of the authors are very well known, who you wouldn't necessarily think of as classic authors, like Faye Weldon. And her novel Down Among the Women, which is in this classic list, certainly isn't her best known. I mean, people tend to think of her for things like The Life and Loves of a She-Devil, which was made into a TV series. And some of the other authors, Helen McCloy, Margaret Kennedy, they're known if you worked in the industry for a long time, but they're not necessarily that well known to the public. And there is another publisher, Persephone, who've been producing a forgotten classics range for years. And they are beautiful looking. They're these beautiful paperback editions. They've got very distinctive dove gray covers and lovely flaps, and they look nice. And this brings us back to the question, why is there a resurgence in the classics? And it's partly because of the way they look now. So not just Persephone, but the likes of Vintage, who are a Random House imprint, are producing really beautiful physical editions of very established classics by Jane Austen, Mary Shelley, Bram Stoker, which begs the question, why are they selling so well when most of the classics are old, they're out of copyright, you can download and read them for next to nothing. And I think the reason they're still buying them is that people, publishers now, realize that physical books, particularly classics, have to have really high production values to appeal to people as collectibles and as gifts. So this Vintage cloth-bound classic series, they have, it has beautiful color, marbled end papers. It has a sprayed edge so that there's this lovely block of color when you turn the book on one side. It has a bookmark, a ribbon. It's very, and it has a very tactile cloth-bound finish. So it looks like a lovely thing. And I think the final reason now about classics enjoying a resurgence is, as all roads these days eventually lead back to social media and the book influences on TikTok and Instagram elsewhere, they all love them. They all love the fact that these books look beautiful. So they have influenced publishers' choice of what they reissue as a classic. So people like Jane Austen plays to the modern trope of romance. Dracula and Frankenstein play into the modern trends of horror and fantasy horror. So the world of classics is kind of going full circle and appealing now to modern social media. And it's a very interesting route. And in terms of sales, long may that continue.
Yeah, it's really interesting, I suppose, thinking of the same way when you think about music, how many artists that are hugely successful today will be remembered in 50 years' time. It's a similar kind of thing, isn't it? Huge bestsellers, Colleen Hoover, for example, Freda McFadden, that have been taking over the bestseller charts for the last few years. I mean, who knows? We don't really know the answer, and that's the point. But will they be classics in 50, 100 years?
Absolutely. It's sort of, they may be the publishing equivalent of boy bands and girl groups. You know, they may have their 15 minutes of fame and then disappear.
Interesting. We have to pay tribute to the late, great Jilly Cooper.
Yeah, very sad. She died recently, very suddenly, aged 88. And the word that's being used to describe books is bonkbuster. And it's a genre many said she invented, but of course the idea of a novel with a lot of sex in it is not a new one. Think of Jackie Collins in the 60s and 70s, D.H. Lawrence, certainly had a lot of sex and in fact got banned for it with Lady Chatterley's Lover. And you know, if you go back to the ancient Greek and Roman writers, and there's a fair amount of sex there as well. So Jilly Cooper, she's never been fashionable. She's never been critically well received, but there are a lot of very respected and prize-winning literary authors who can only dream of selling 11 million copies, which she has done in the UK alone, let alone all the foreign rights sales. And she was the embodiment of the old saying, write about what you know, because she was quite posh herself. She was from the countryside. She loved the Cotswolds. And she wrote about posh country people having affairs and a lot of sex. And it's interesting that she herself had a marriage that lasted for decades, despite having had an affair herself, which is interesting. Mm. But she started writing stories for magazines, as a lot of writers did in the late 1960s. And she gradually fleshed these out, see what I did there, into full-length novels. And her first big hit was a book called Rivals in 1985. And there is a tremendous backstory which she tells against herself, which is she originally finished it in 1969. So there was a 16-year gap between her finishing it and it coming out. It had a different title when she wrote it originally. It was called Bloods. But she only had one copy of the manuscript and she lost it on a number 22 London bus after what she described as, quote, a very liquid lunch. So it was a very expensive and time-consuming mistake, and that she had to piece the whole thing together again. And after Rivals, the books sort of followed a theme. They tended to have one-word titles. So there was Polo, And she even branched out into the world of footballers' wives and wags with a book called Tackle, which was published in 2023, so only 2 years ago, and when she was already 86. And her audience kind of regenerated itself because Rivals last year found a whole new audience on Disney Plus, who 40 years later turned it into a sort of streaming bonkbuster. And she was the executive producer and apparently was thrilled. She was on set. She was charming to everybody. And that was her, really. I mean, I never met her, even though she was one of our authors. She used to come to quite a lot of our sales conferences and present the books and then talk with everyone afterwards. And she was always enthusiastic. She was friendly. She was incredibly nice to everyone, irrespective of how far up the food chain or you were in publishing, which is very rare. For there are a lot of authors who are a lot less prestigious and certainly less best-selling than her, who are not as nice as that. She had no agenda with anybody, and nobody had a bad word to say about her. So she will be missed for all sorts of reasons.
Oh, definitely. I had the huge honor and pleasure of interviewing her twice on Zoom or on the phone or whatever. And she's one of two people in my over 20 year radio career who wrote a handwritten letter to say thank you for the interview.
That's classy, isn't it?
Isn't it amazing?
Normally for authors that famous, there may be an attitude of you're lucky to get me.
Well, quite. And that's absolutely how I felt. But no, she literally sent me a handwritten letter. Dear Hannah, thank you so much for having me on your show. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Best of luck, Jilly Cooper, something like that.
I think that's absolutely typical of who she was.
Yeah.
That's lovely.
Really lovely. I replayed the interview the day after she died on my afternoon show. And yeah, it was lovely hearing it back. It was from 2018, I think it was the last time I spoke to her. And she was talking about the writing of Tackle because she'd just started it. And it came about because she sat next to Sir Alex Ferguson at a charity dinner. And she said he was ever so charming and they got on really well. And she thought, oh, why don't I write about a book set in the football world? And that's how it came about.
Well, Posh and Becks. I mean, Victoria Beckham was the original wag, wasn't she?
Yeah, exactly. Amazing. We have also learnt of the winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yes, and I'm very kindly not going to get you to pronounce his name.
Thank you.
Because it's Hungarian, and I'm going to have a go. It's László Krajnokorkai.
Well done, I think.
For any Hungarian listeners out there, I apologize for mangling your language. I mean, the reason I brought this up is I'm ashamed to say I've never heard of him. So I did my research. He's 71. He's Hungarian. And he writes what are described as dystopian, melancholic novels. So I'm not sure I'll be reading him anytime soon. not that he has to worry about what I think, because he's just won £900,000. But if you do want to read him, a lot of his novels, like Santantango, which was made into a 7-hour-long film, are published in English by an imprint called Serpent's Tale, which is part of a publisher called Profile. But weirdly, he seems to be one of these very, very reluctant celebrities. He's very dismissive about his own work. And he was once quoted in an interview as saying, "If there are readers who haven't read my books, I couldn't recommend anything to read to them. Instead, I'd advise them to go out, sit down somewhere, perhaps by the side of a brook with nothing to do, nothing to think about, just remaining in silence like stones. They will eventually meet someone who has already read my books." And at this point, I can almost hear the sound of his publicist crying softly in a corner about the way the interview's going. Jilly Cooper, he is not, it is fair to say.
Yes.
And I'm probably guessing you may not be rushing to phone Serpent's Tale to invite him on the book show.
You're quite right.
Yeah, but it also set me thinking about the Nobel Prize. And I know you're an enthusiastic quizzer and a quiz master as well. So a few facts to jot down. The Nobel Prize for Literature was first awarded in 1901. So it's now been awarded 118 times. Can you guess how many times a woman has won it? in 118.
Oh, goodness. The Nobel Prize for Literature. Five?
Take a wild stab. Yeah, that's a bit pessimistic. It's 18.
Okay.
And I'll give you a guess at the youngest and oldest. So the youngest was Rudyard Kipling, who won it in 1907. Can you guess how old he was?
1907. 23?
No, he was 41. So they tend to award it to people after they've got a decent body.
Oh, yeah,
of
a
work.
Bit of a life. Yeah, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, sorry.
So,
okay.
But 41 is exceptionally young to win it. Now, the oldest was Doris Lessing, who won it not so long ago, 2007. Can you guess how old she was?
Was she over 100? Not sure. 98?
88. Not the same. Okay. So not a bad stab. I was interested to read that three authors have refused to accept the award after having been given it. The most recent being Jean-Paul Sartre in 1964. But if you want a real quiz question, and going back to the fact that I was intrigued by this because I've never heard of the current winner, when it was first awarded in 1901, I'd never heard of this writer either. It was a French philosopher-poet called Sully Prudhomme, and I am absolutely none the wiser. But also quite interesting is a list of authors who've never won it. So if you think of, you know, fantastic 20th century literature, Tolstoy, Ibsen, Henry James, Graham Greene, never won it. So prizes aren't always the be-all and end-all, even the Nobel.
No. Interestingly, for my quiz that I'm hosting this week, I have a question about which singer-songwriter won the Nobel Prize for Literature in, I can't remember the year, but I'm thinking you might know the answer.
Is it Bob Dylan?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. He is one of only two people who've won an Oscar and a Nobel Prize. Do you know who the other one was?
An Oscar and a Nobel Prize for Literature or just Nobel Prize?
Nobel Prize for Literature, but they've also won an Oscar.
Oh, I don't
and
know.
Dylan is one because he won an Oscar for a soundtrack.
Okay.
The other one is George Bernard Shaw. Who in the adaptation of My Fair Lady has a writing credit. Yeah, for Pygmalion, has a writing credit for one of the songs which won an Oscar. So the other answer is George Bernard Shaw.
Wow. Good knowledge. Love that. And to mention a couple of new novels coming out.
Well, yes, one in fact, which is a new novel by Elizabeth Strout, who's a wonderful writer. And you'll have to wait a little bit. It's coming out on the 7th of May next year. But if it's Elizabeth Strout, it will be worth waiting for. It's called The Things We Never Say. And the interesting thing is it doesn't feature her previous characters because she is best known for writing principally about two characters. So this novel does feature a high school teacher in Massachusetts, a man called Artie Dam. But he hasn't appeared in her novels before. So her two main characters that she's habitually gone back to, one is Olive Kitteridge, and she wrote a novel of the same name, which was published in 2008, and that was her first big hit. Massive commercial success, sold over 1 million copies, sold language rights all the way around the world, and won the Pulitzer Prize. So she really hit the jackpot. And then did a follow-up called Olive Again in 2019. And in between, wrote about a character called Lucy Barton. She published a novel called My Name is Lucy Barton in 2016. And it's a very moving novel about a mother and daughter who reconnect when the daughter, who is Lucy Barton, is seriously in hospital. And I saw a fantastic stage adaptation of it in London, which toured all around the world, starring Laura Linney, who's a wonderful American actress.
Yeah.
But for anyone who has had... how can I put it? A slightly more complex mother-daughter relationship. You will definitely relate to My Name is Lucy Barton. And Lucy Barton as a character appears in later novels. Anything is Possible, Oh, William, Lucy by the Sea, Tell Me Everything. And she writes beautifully. So I'm really looking forward to reading the manuscript of this one.
Yeah, exciting. Well, thank you very much, as always, Guy Lloyd, International Sales Manager for Penguin Random House. Thank you for being with us, and we look forward to catching up with you in November.
Always a pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Projecta Kohli, also known as Mostly Sane, one of India's most loved and successful digital content creators with over 18 million followers across social media platforms. As an actor, Projecta is best known for her lead role in Netflix's Mismatched. She's featured in both GQ India and Hollywood Reporter's Most Influential Indians list. She has also featured in Michelle Obama's Daytime Emmy-winning docu-series promoting girls' education. She's with us on The Book Show to talk about her debut novel, Too Good to Be True. It's a sparkling, true blue, will-they-won't-they love story you've been waiting for. Welcome to The Book Show, Projecta.
Hi, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor.
It's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. So what kind of came first for you then, the acting or the social media influencing? How did it all start?
It's so funny because now that I'm into making content for more than 10 years, I kind of look back and it's all kind of just like a jumbled mess because I always knew that I wanted to be in the performing arts of some sort. My dream as a child was to be a radio jockey, which I did end up becoming, and then failed at it miserably because I got fired. And
in time,
kind of realized that, okay, I am not good at this job. But I used to do theater before I started doing, started interning at a radio station in Mumbai. And I quite enjoyed being on stage. I loved theater and I loved acting. I loved learning it while I was performing it. And then content creation came around where I started making content on YouTube. Then that went to Instagram. That kind of dominoed into a lot of the other conversations with girls' education. That's how the documentary kind of came through. And then 6 years ago, I got a call to audition for the Netflix show Mismatched. And then kind of that was a whole different story. So I really don't know what came first, you know, but I think I just started earning money first as a theater actor. So I'm going to say acting came first.
Yeah. And what was it like being involved in the lead role in this Mismatched?
It was crazy. It's actually my first professional job as an actor outside of what I was doing in my organic YouTube universe, because I used to do kind of comedy sketches. I used to write my own stuff, perform it, and that went on for a few years before I started auditioning. It was very, very new. And I'm so grateful, honestly, that kind of went through for me. Panchami Ghavri, who is our casting director, huge shout out to her for kind of casting me into this and testing me for this. But we go on floors with season 4 very soon. So that's crazy. I'm quite looking forward to it still.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, because when you start a new series, I suppose there are no guarantees that there'll be a series 2 or series 3. So that's great.
Yeah. It's amazing. We're so happy that the audience has kind of just, you know, continuously showed us the love.
Yeah. And for anyone who's never seen it, can you just say what Mismatched is about?
So Mismatched is a romance drama. And it's extremely light and it's snacky. It's about this girl called Dimple and she and Rishi, who is the male lead. So Dimple actually is this girl who's trying to kind of study. She's a coder, she's a gamer, and she wants to become an app developer. But she comes from a very simple middle-class household from a city in Rajasthan in India called... Oh, no, that's where we shot it. My story. From a place called Ambala in India. She comes from there. And Rishi actually is a young romantic who... wants to get married. So they end up meeting in a setup which he knows about but she doesn't know about, and he doesn't know that she doesn't know. So it starts with a lot of chaos, but eventually I think Rishi and Dimple together are so beautiful. So if you're a fan of romances, if you're a fan of light-hearted drama about teenage love, I think Mismatched is what you should try.
Oh, fantastic. And did it kind of inspire you to write this novel, because this has got romance in it, hasn't it?
Not really. I mean, not directly, at least, because honestly, I've always been a huge fan of romance. I've loved watching romance. I mean, I grew up in India, and in the Hindi film industry, romance is huge. I mean, I grew up with Shah Rukh Khan, so I have all, I have the golden goose of romance in our country. So I've always loved it as a genre. It's also a genre I enjoy reading a lot, watching a lot. I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I'll always listen to romance. So romance was actually one of the things that I always wanted to write because it's also something I miss watching. As someone who spends as much time as she does online, I somehow started feeling like I really, really miss reading and watching that much romance, which is why Mismatch kind of coming to me was great. But when it came to writing and developing stuff, I always knew that I wanted to write romance. So in a way, definitely, I mean, Mismatch has helped me in understanding how to tell the story. But then again, I was rarely involved in the writing of the show. I mean, we have very, very capable writers and makers who kind of made it. So this was all on my own, but yeah.
Oh, great. So how did you find the process of writing then for the first time?
I've always written, actually. I used to write a blog for many years. And then when I started creating content for my channel, I used to write my own scripts. And I used to love working on character development. So that was one of my hooks into like writing more. So during the lockdown, when all of us were sitting at home, everybody had a lot more time, I started putting writer's rooms together for a few ideas that I had to see if I can kind of, you know, develop them and then eventually pitch them, sell them to studios, to OTT platforms, to production houses, stuff like that. The book actually was supposed to be a 6-part series, like a show that I was trying to write. But it was such a simple, but I thought it was such a beautiful concept that I was like, okay, let me see if I, what I can do with this by myself without kind of putting a team together to develop it. Let me try making the first pitch myself. And when I started writing my thoughts down, I realized that these are long, long excerpts that look like chapters. So I think about 5-6 in, I was like, let me just try this. It was never on the cards to write a book so early on. But I gave it a try and I'm so glad that I did because it kind of helped me in falling in love with the whole art of writing as well.
Yeah, amazing. So it's obviously meant to be a novel, even though you didn't realize it initially.
I didn't realize it, exactly.
So is this the first of many? Could there be a sequel?
Not a sequel, but there will be more, yes.
Oh, exciting. So tell us about the main characters in Too Good to Be True.
So Too Good to Be True is about Aman and Avni. Avni is a law student who works part-time at a bookstore because obviously she is a fan of romance novels as well. And Aman, and she's also a romance cynic. Aman, on the other hand, is what every perfect book boyfriend is. You know, I went on these tours, I went to all these cities, and everybody who's read the book kept asking me, where will we find Aman? And my answer is nowhere. You will only find him in a book. That's what makes him beautiful. You know, because if you find him in real life, he's going to leave wet towels on the floor. And then that's not going to be the perfect book boyfriend. So Aman is the most stereotypical book hunk that there can be in a romance, ideal romance world. And they meet in the bookstore. He obviously wears his heart on his sleeve. She's a cynic. And it's about how they kind of end up finding each other. And it's called Too Good to Be True because that's what she thinks he is. She's constantly waiting for the other shoe to drop. But she's like, something's terribly wrong with this guy. How can he be so perfect? And then eventually you find out what happens. But that's as basic as that is. Anybody who asks me about the book, I always tell them that it's an extremely ordinary story of two characters I find extraordinary. I think it's a very, very ordinary telling of their life.
Oh, and was it fun coming up with the characters? It was obviously fun coming up with Aman describing the perfect man.
Aman was a lot of fun to come up with. You know, it was everything that I have ever dreamt of into one character. And Avni, actually, because this was my first book and I hadn't written so much and published even more before this, I went with the lowest hanging fruit. So Avni is very, very me. Like, I have completely put my who I am as a person into her. Because that was the easiest for me to do. Now, in the second book that I'm working on, those are different characters. So now I'll know how I really work on female characters as well. But right now, for Aman and Avni, that's who they are.
Oh, sounds great. Well, if people want to get a copy of Too Good to Be True, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Pragata Kohli, who we've been chatting with. Pragata, thank you so much for joining us. Great to chat with you.
Thank you. Thanks so much. So nice talking to you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Trilina Pucci. She's a best-selling romance author with a twist, often blending genres with her signature romantic comedies. In her latest One Killer Night, which is set in Halloween, she combines romance, comedy and psychological suspense to create an unputdownable read that is both hilarious and dark. Welcome to the book show, Trilina.
Thank you so much for having me. You make me sound so fabulous.
Well, I think it's great what you do. What inspired you to kind of mix all the genres together?
Oh, I do that historically throughout all my books. It feels stifling to stay in the same genre, so I really like to mix it up and keep it fresh each time I write something new. And I love Halloween. It was a no-brainer when it came to writing this book that I wanted to break out into kind of thrillers, and I thought that that would be a fun mix, romance and horror.
Yeah, definitely. And what about dark humor? Because I know that plays a big role in your writing.
I mean, I think that I'm just naturally a sarcastic person. Sometimes, I think fortunately, to other people's misfortune sometimes, but I love dark humor. I'm a really big fan of British humor. And I find that dark humor and sarcasm plays a very big role in that. And I think that that's just kind of sculpted me throughout the years. And so it finds itself in every single thing that I write.
Yeah, makes sense, doesn't it? If you're writing from the heart, that comes into it.
Yeah. I love it. I mean, it feels, you know, anytime I craft a joke, I don't necessarily love to just pick the low-hanging fruit. I want to think of something not just hilarious, but that is sometimes feels like commentary too. And so that dark humor or like sarcasm lends itself to that a lot.
Yeah. So tell us about your characters in this book.
So the book starts off with Noah and Goldie. It's based around Noah and Goldie. There are some hilarious side characters, a best friend and a sister. But the book is situated around Noah and Goldie, who meet inside of a Walgreens or a CVS or a pharmacy store, for whatever can be relatable. They meet inside of that while she's buying fake blood for her sister because it is Halloween. And he is just shopping for more candy. And she is dressed in a inflatable dinosaur costume, and chemistry ignites, and he thinks she's the cutest girl he's ever seen ever, and she invites him to a party, and that starts their love affair. He is a sneaker designer, a hopeful sneaker designer one day, and she is a florist who is a hopeful writer one day. So they meet themselves in the midst of becoming who they are as people, and then kind of go on that journey together.
And what
amidst
kind
of other really scary hijinks. Yeah.
And what kind of age are they?
This book in particular, they're both in their 30s, so early 30s.
Okay. And what about the setting? Do we know where it's set? Where in the world?
It's set in Boston in the United States. It also takes place, but it's a real light setting because I love to pick a city that I adore, and then I love to lean into fiction. So if people are looking for accurate driving descriptions, they're not going to get them. but I love just fall in Boston and the leaves and the brick and I love the feel of it. And I'm used off of that small town in Stars Hollow in Gilmore Girls as well. So I kind of combined those two and made that my perfect city.
Yeah, great. And have you got a kind of writing style that you've developed over the years where you a specific way that you write or certain time of day?
You know, I dictate most of my books, so I don't I do write them with my fingers, but for the most part the whole skeleton of my book is done by dictation. So I just pace around my room eating gummy worms, talking to myself all day long. And then I sit down and start to fill it in and make it a little bit more coherent because I tend to speak in like kind of a stream of consciousness. So I'm a fast talker. So that dictation works for me because I'm a slow typer.
Yeah.
And I write any time of day that strikes me. When the mood strikes is when I write. I try to do it in the morning most of the time because I'm not really a late owl. So, but sometimes the mood strikes and I just have to write at night.
And do you plan things before you write? Have you kind of planned everything out? Do you know what's happening at the end and everything?
Yeah, I know I always know how it begins, how they meet, and I always know how it's going to end. And I typically know about 5 or 6 scenes within the book that are super important and I know have to go in. But for the most part, I try not to plan too much because I like to go where the characters take me and where the story is taking me. So I have a very loose skeleton of what it looks like. And then I just kind of fly by the seat of my pants.
Have to allow yourself to be flexible, I suppose.
Well, I think that for me, it doesn't work for everyone. Some people need a huge structure, and I think that that's admirable. That's great for them. But for me, I need to have the freedom of change and choice and have that. It makes me feel creative to not have a boundary.
Yeah.
Much like how I change my genre all the time. I don't like to be put in a box.
So do you have a notebook full of ideas for future books, or do you sit down each time and go, right, what am I going to do now?
No, I do. I leave voice notes for myself. Sometimes I'll see a couple on the street. Sometimes I'll see, like yesterday I heard a really cute, I know that everyone, I think around the world, everybody has that show Love is Blind.
Yes.
Does that... Okay. So I was watching the Love is Blind last night, and there was a girl was telling a story about how her parents met. And it was actually a very cute story about how elevator doors opened and he saw the mother and thought, that is the woman I'm going to marry. He had never spoken to her.
Wow.
And then,
you know,
30 years later, they were still married, children, happy life, like blah, blah, blah. And I thought, what a cute idea for a story about like a girl who's in a rush and doesn't even know, and a guy who just becomes smitten and she has no idea. She rushes past and like the love of his life just walked in. I thought, what a cute entrance. And so I made a voice note for myself for a future story, like super cute, meet cute. And I have a million voice notes of just little ideas that I come up with when I see things.
Oh, great. And with regards to publishing, I know that you've done a lot of independent publishing before, but this is the first book that's traditionally published, which is very exciting. How did the change happen?
You know, I could give an answer that sounds incredible, but the truth is the hustle in independent publishing is difficult. It's hard. It's tiring. It's taxing. And I just wanted to have a team behind me that was as dedicated to the cause as I was for myself all this time. And it is incredibly expensive to indie publish, which is what makes it so inaccessible to so many, to publish well and to get your book really out there, to have a successful career at it. And so I just felt like I had gotten to the place where I didn't need to do the work on my own anymore. I could let other people take things over. I could use some collaboration on things, and I could still flourish and have enough say. And I was right. I picked a good team. It's been a really collaborative process. They've been incredibly great about letting me have veto power over things that I just don't think are going to work. My opinion is respected. I really love it. I don't want to turn back.
And was it easy to get published and to get a publisher? Because it can be really difficult for some.
No, not even a little. I mean, if people tell you this game, it's just as easy as getting an agent, they're lying to you. It was incredibly hard. In fact, a lot of people that start independently published first, they have their backlist picked up. So a book that's already popular, a publisher comes in and goes, hey, let us help you get that to even more people because it's already popular, right? The hard work has pretty much been done on your end. And a lot of my friends have gone that route. And for me, I went in with a very brand new book, like as a debut author. So it took me, oh gosh, this has been years in the making. I mean, I got turned down by everybody you could think of. It took me forever to get an agent. It was so difficult. No, everybody was like, who are you? You're not viral. We don't know who you are. Even though I had a successful independent career, they were just like, who are you? You know, you're not big on TikTok. So it was a rough road. I mean, I really put in the work for it. But once you find a team that makes sense for you and that you identify with, that you really love and you feel like they are on board for you, it's a wonderful, wonderful experience from there. But it is a very difficult road of no's. It's paved with no.
And with regards to series, this is a standalone, isn't it? Could there be a sequel?
Yes, I get so excited. Yes, there is a sequel to the book. So it can be read as a standalone, but there is a sequel to it. And the epilogue will make people want to pick up the sequel quickly. And it comes out in February. It's called Evil is Forever.
Oh, exciting. Good stuff. Well, in the meantime, if listeners want to get a copy of One Killer Night, it's available now on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Trilina Pucci, who we've been chatting with. Trilina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE.
Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to the second hour of tonight's book show. In the first hour, we were chatting with Guy Lloyd, Projacta Coley and Trilina Pucci. In this hour, we're chatting to Victor Wind. He's a writer, artist and proprietor of the eponymous Museum of Curiosities, Fine Art and Unnatural History in London. He regularly leads expeditions to Papua New Guinea, the Congo and beyond, taking small groups with him via his boutique travel agency, Gone with the Wind. Dark Fairy Tales is a collection of stories that he's collected from around the world that are definitely not suitable for children. We're also chatting to Marilyn Horowitz, an award-winning author, retired New York University professor, TV show creator and writing coach, working with successful novelists, produced screenwriters and award-winning filmmakers. Her new dark comedy novel, Bad Girl Pie, is set in New York City, where Dorothy Sherlock, a prolific ghostwriter, shares her running commentary on the absurdity of the human condition as she navigates her future. Dorothy resolves to write her own book, blending her expertise in dieting and dessert. And finally on tonight's book show is Kristin Lush, who holds a BA in history as well as a master's degree in Slavonic studies from the University of Cambridge. Her latest novel, The Hong Kong Widow, is a haunting gothic thriller involving six séances over six nights. Perfect for Halloween. And that is tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Depends in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your
Joining us on the line now is Victor Wind. He's a writer, artist and the proprietor of the eponymous Museum of Curiosities, Fine Art and Unnatural History in London. He regularly leads expeditions to Papua New Guinea, the Congo and beyond, taking small groups with him via his boutique travel agency, Gone with the Wind. He's with us on the book show to talk about his latest book, Dark Fairy Tales, stories from around the world that are definitely not suitable for children. It's an enticing collection of alternative tales populated by fairies, shapeshifters, ogres and magical beings, and it promises a reading experience that is macabre and entertaining. On his extensive travels, he has amassed a trove of stories filled with risque twists, grotesque details and endings that are surprisingly happy, though not always in the way one might expect. Welcome to the book show, Victor.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you with us. And I love your travel agency name, Gone with the Wind. Very clever. Brilliant.
Literally, like yesterday, came back from West Papua. My head doesn't know where it is or what it's doing.
Oh, bless you. How did you get into all of that? I mean, expeditions to these weird and wonderful places, very exciting.
I've never, since I was a child, been able to look at a map and not want to go to the places on it. And I've been drawn to New Guinea all my life. And this was my second trip there this year, and I'm going back again in January. It's obsessed me. It's underneath my skin. It's another world. It's a world where people live with spirits, where people see their dreams as being every bit as real as their waking day.
Gosh, amazing. So how would you describe the place? What's it like to visit?
Well, each place is unique. There's over 1,200 different peoples in New Guinea. I've just been with the Asmat. The Asmat are perhaps best known for having eaten Michael Rockefeller in the 60s and for producing most extraordinary material culture, sort of great ancestor poles with enormous erections and intricately or spectacularly carved shields. And
how do they see you when you visit these people?
Well, we went to a place which had never had, went into the north of the Asmat, which has, none of the villages we went to had ever had a tourist visit before. And they've probably never seen white people before either. And they were very, very curious, I'd say. It's difficult because in Papua New Guinea, there's always someone who'll speak English, whereas in West Papua, which is the Indonesian half, one has to talk through interpreters. So they're sort of as interested in why we are going there as we are in them.
Yeah. And you always feel safe when you're there?
Put it this way. When I got to Jakarta, on my way back, I slipped and I stubbed my toe, which is very painful. And when I got to Heathrow, I picked up one of my enormous bags to put it in the taxi, but the bag stayed still and my back got out. So traveling is very dangerous, but the most dangerous bit is when you're at home.
Yes, fair enough. So tell us about this museum that you look after.
Well, a museum's a sort of exploded version of the inside of my mind, filled with all the things that sort of sparkle and intrigue me, full of sort of beautiful and strange things, from mermaids and unicorns to shrunken heads and seashells, fairies. It's about stories as much as anything else. It's full of many thousands of things, each one labelled and each one sort of sparking a conversation and the way they talk to each other.
And how long have you been running it for?
That's been about 20 years now.
Wow, amazing. And whereabouts is it in London?
It's in Hackney in East London.
Okay.
Near Bethnal Green Station. You should come with us.
Yes, will do. And how did this latest book come about then, Dark Fairy Tales?
Well, I suppose I am a storyteller in everything that I do, and I have been telling fairy tales for at least since my late teens, because I wanted to understand fairy tales. I still like to understand fairy tales, but I realised they're not meant to be read. They're meant to be heard, and meant to be performed. And so I started going to hear storytellers, and I started telling stories myself. And wherever I go, I tend to find stories. And I've been telling them for so many years. I thought it would be quite fun to write down some of my favourites. But also, in many ways, my books are sort of a manifesto for people to stop being sort of passive consumers and to start telling stories and providing their own entertainment. So the book, as you probably know, has a couple of chapters on how to tell stories in it as well. So what I'm hoping is that with people who have this book, they'll read it aloud to someone, even if it's just their cat, and then maybe they'll be inspired and they'll start telling the stories from the book or telling other stories that they like.
Yeah, definitely. So how should one tell a story?
Well, there's no one way of telling a story. It's however it works for you. I tend to break a story down. I'll start when I hear a story. I need to write down, I do it by hand. I need to write as much as I can remember of the story. And then I sort of break it into bullet points, or sort of, I think of it more as a map. And you've got to get from A to B to C to D to E. But how you get between those points is very different. I think the main thing is opening your mind and letting the story live. In some ways, easiest way to explain it is that I think stories are like viruses. They get inside your head and they live there, and then they come out and infect someone else. And sometimes they come out exactly the same way you heard them, and sometimes they come to life and come out in a different way. I really, if I'm being honest, I'm an animist, and I, as much as I believe that everything in this world is alive, I also believe that the stories are alive, and I think they come and live within us. So when stories are told, they don't necessarily come out the same way, and it isn't necessarily me telling them, it's the characters telling them. And I found it very interesting when I was writing the book, because I'd never written these stories down sort of longhand, and they came out in a way that's different perhaps to the way I would perform them.
Yeah, interesting. And are they a mixture of stories that you have heard from around the world and stories that you've written yourself?
They're all stories that I have been told to me, and they're stories from which we had to sort of narrow it down, because there's hundreds of stories. So it's stories from seven that I've heard in seven different countries, from Papua New Guinea and Borneo, more recently to my childhood going on holiday in Ireland and Wales, and adventures with lovers in Germany and Norway. And of course, in Arabian fairy tales.
Interesting. So the stories that have been told to you personally through people you've met?
Yes. I mean, I'm not saying it's one-on-one, but I've been in the audience when these stories were being told.
Yeah, nice. And how is it that they're all dark? Is that a coincidence, or is that what you've sort of seeked out to find?
I know that's definitely what I like. It's definitely when I hear a story and someone's being eaten by a troll or being raped by a polar bear, I prick my ears up and think, "Ooh, that's one for me."
Amazing. So, can you give us
some things? Don't. And, I mean, I'm not saying that there are. And fairy tales, though, I think it's the nature of fairy tales to be nasty.
You think?
I think so, but there's a nature of the world to be nasty too. I mean, it's hard to think of a good fairy tale that doesn't have a bit of nastiness in it, even if sometimes they all end happily ever after, and the nasty people get their comeuppance. But that's also slightly a Disneyfication of it, because we know that good people don't necessarily live happily ever after, and bad people don't necessarily get eaten.
No, very, very true.
Sometimes it doesn't.
Yes.
So it depends on the teller, because you can tell the story. The story can come out one way or the other.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of some of the stories in the book?
There's a rather lovely one from Borneo about a childless couple, and they long and long. I've had to cut it short, but they long for a baby, and it's very unfortunate to... You know, you must be very careful of what you wish for. So when they do get this baby, they find it. They're so pleased with it. But, you know, terrible things happen to it. First of all, it sucks the mother dry, not only drinks from her breast, but sucks all her blood out. And then when the father gets very cross and rips it off with the breast still in the baby's mouth, and he chops it in half with his machete, it's full of leeches. And he stamps on as many as he can, but he doesn't get them all, and they crawl off and infect the world.
Oh, gosh. I can see why this isn't for children, then.
It isn't for children. And, of course, by putting an enlarged letters on the book, this is not for children. One does rather hope that children will read it, though there are very unsuitable bits in it, depending on if you sort of take the Victorian view that, you know, children growing up, you know, see animals doing things to each other and probably in, you know, cramped environments that people used to live would possibly be in the bed while their parents are making their siblings.
And I want to ask you about Norway. Have you got a story from Norway that you can remember?
There's three stories from Norway. They're all delightfully horrible. There's three trolls who share one eye between them and trick two boys to coming up into the mountains. But, well, while they're fantasizing about how they're going to cook these boys and how they're going to eat them, one of the boys manages to steal their eye.
Wow. Well, you've obviously had great fun putting the book together. You say it was difficult to decide which stories to include because there were so many.
It is. I mean, there's hundreds or thousands of stories that I've heard and I've sort of got somewhere in the back of my mind. But I just sort of let the ones sort of, by doing it by region and doing just seven different countries and just three from each one. I mean, originally, I think it was going to be about 12 different countries, but of course we ran out of space in the book. Maybe there'll be a volume two. We can go to places. There's wonderful stories from the Amazon about the dolphins, because the dolphins turn into very good looking men and seduce girls at parties and take them back to Encanto beneath the Amazon. It'd be nice to include a few of those.
And I'm intrigued where you go and who you meet to hear these kinds of stories, because I've been to a couple of the countries, including Norway, that you mentioned in the book, and obviously not come across these kinds of stories myself.
So. I have this feeling that it's everyone has a sort of latent, you could call it a superpower. It's, you know, some people can turn on a television and find something interesting to watch. I can't do that. Some people will, wherever they go, they'll find a football match that they like, or they'll find a good pub, or they'll find the sort of plants they like. Whereas I'm attracted to stories. So wherever I go, I sort of stumble into some sort of storytelling. But, you know, you obviously, luck is the goddess that dictates our life, but one sort of helps the luck. So I'm looking for stories. I'm asking people for stories. If I happen to sort of spy a sign up saying there's a storytelling festival, I sort of go trotting along to that in the same way that someone else who was into board games would probably find, if they went to Norway, they'd sort of pop into a cafe and discover people were playing board games and join in and play a new board game. And I'll sort of off into somewhere, say, oh, look, there's storytelling in the back room. Let's go to that.
Yes, no, fair enough. And have you always been into storytelling since a young child?
Well, you know, my wife says I'm a congenital liar, but I think I'm a storyteller. So yes, I've always told stories. I've always listened to stories. I mean, some of the stories start with this. The book starts with the stories that I listened to as a child when we used to go to Wales, and it would rain as it always rains, and we'd be camping, and the farmer's wife would ask us into the farmhouse, and sometimes the farmer's mother would tell us these wonderful tales.
Oh, nice. Well, if people want to get a copy of Dark Fairy Tales, stories from around the world that are definitely not suitable for children, it's available now on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Victor Wind, who we've been chatting with. Victor, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Great pleasure.
Hello, little Alan Bennett here. If I'm not writing books, then the thing I like most is listening to the book club on Talk Radio Europe. fancy.
Joining us on the line now is Marilyn Horowitz. She's an award-winning author, retired New York University professor, TV show creator and writing coach, working with successful novelists, produced screenwriters and award-winning filmmakers. Two of her students have been nominated for an Emmy. Since 1998, she's taught hundreds of aspiring writers to complete their feature-length screenplays, novels and TV pilots using her trademarked writing method, the Horowitz system. She's the author of The Word of the Day Practice, Transform Your Writing in 15 Minutes a Day. She's with us on the book show to talk about her new dark comedy novel, Bad Girl Pie. Set in New York City, it's about Dorothy Sherlock, a prolific ghostwriter who shares her running commentary on the absurdity of the human condition as she navigates her future. Dorothy resolves to write her own book, blending her expertise in dieting and dessert. Welcome to the book show, Marilyn.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really flattered. Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. And what amazing life and career you've had, all this writing and helping other people to write. How did you get into that?
Well, it's always one of the things where, you know, when you're doing the right thing, it finds you. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I was the itinerant writer. I had ADHD, so I was never a typist. I never worked in an office. I was a cook. And as a catering person, I learned a lot about life and the business. At a certain point, one of my friends got pregnant. She said, well, you have a film degree. I have a film degree from New York University. I made a film. I sold it. I had a brief, flashy career as a filmmaker. So I took it back on, got pregnant. She got pregnant. I took over her class at the School of Visual Arts. And within a year, for some reason, I had a full practice. People figured out that I was able to help them with their stories. And it was kind of like, you know, those chia pets where you put water in and all of a sudden the thing is growing herbs. That was my career. So I was very, very lucky. I come from a mixed, my pedigree is that both my father and my grandfather were different times CEO of Columbia Pictures. So I come from the legal side of the movie business. And then my father was later a founder of MTV, and my grandfather was a founder of ASCAP, which is a music rights. So I come from a mixed creative business, and so I had a particular edge, which is I actually knew how to get people to be able to stay solvent and focused long enough to succeed. Plus, I had created this method, which was a result. It's a long story of me selling my first novel to Hollywood over a weekend at a party and then being tortured by the producer for 3 years as I turned it from a psychological thriller that was a whodunit to a howdunit. And after that experience, I really had learned how to write, and so I shared it. So it was one of those things, as I say, my career was like a pet rock. Boom. You know, I just suddenly was doing what I was doing.
Yeah, amazing. And when you're helping other people, there must be a time when you're looking at someone's story and they might be really proud of what they've done and you're reading it thinking, oh God, this is terrible. This is not going to work. How do you deal with situations like that?
Well, it's a very good question. One of the things that I did a long time ago was I separated talent from craft. That was the part of the writing method was that I discovered that there was a universal story and that the traditional way we were taught to write was a way to make sure we never told a good one, seriously. And I come from this background, as I said to you, of people who are innovators. And I just thought, this is all wrong. If I can cure myself, my worst student and the most horrible writer I ever met when I started, I can cure anybody. And I cured myself. So, you know, that's how that happened. But the way that I did that was I once read a quote by a famous author who said, if you have a childhood, you have a story. And this is something to think about. Everybody has one. And so I took the position, having done a lot of research, I'm sort of a nerd. I'm interested in, I've studied psychology and neuroscience or whatever. And I thought, okay, how do we get through our lives? We're storytellers, right? Ever lied about anything? You're a storyteller. Okay. So what I realized was if I could use all the different things I knew and synthesize a way for people to use their natural expertise at storytelling to get through life and have them apply it to a piece of fiction, whether it was a screenplay or a novel, then I was working with someone who was an expert but didn't know it. You see?
Oh, definitely.
Now, the talent thing, but I'm going to tell you something, the talent thing you have to leave to one side because sometimes the talent is innate.
And sometimes the talent only shows up after they've finished.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that, because some people obviously do just have a natural talent to write, and they can, you know, knock up a short story really quickly and it sounds really good. And others seem to have great ideas, but whether it's not having the vocabulary or just not being able to tell it in a really engaging, interesting way. And I suppose that's what you have to teach people.
Well, you know, the motto of my writing system, and, you know, I've written 8 books on that topic as well as a bunch of others, is don't get it right, get it written. And the thing that I learned to answer your question was, if the person wrote something that was dreadful, there were 2 kinds of dreadful. There was ignorant and bad. And it's very easy to figure out which one it is. I mean, anybody can do it. If you figure out that someone basically is ignorant, this is where my writing system, which figured out a structure to help anybody tell a story anytime, it's foolproof. One of my books, which is called The 4 Magic Questions of Screenwriting, guarantees that in 2 hours you will have a story, because it was developed originally because as a writing coach, I work with a lot of very successful people in the business who would be going to a pitch meeting the next day. They call me up. They go, "Oh my God, Marilyn, I need to put a story together by tomorrow morning. Can you help me?" And the answer is, sure, no problem. And when I began to teach at NYU, I adapted this system so that I could show anybody how to make a story out of anything. And if it was a bad story, it was still well structured. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And the satisfaction that people felt, I don't think that. In my experience, I have experienced few greater pleasures in having the joy of someone writing the end or fade out, whether it's a, you know, email or a novel. I mean, the joy of completion is not to be underestimated.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this new book, Bad Girl Pie. Where did it come from? I feel like there might be some similarities between you and Dorothy.
There are a few. I mean, we both argue with God a lot. You know, that's definitely something we have in common. But the similarities are not really. I mean, honestly, the character of Dorothy is an homage to my dearest childhood friend who got very severe dementia, and the person that we knew is not there anymore. And I just, you know, I wanted to immortalize her in some way. So the vicious wit is definitely hers, as well as her figure. But the story originally is a good story. So originally I wrote a manuscript, which was really a therapeutic. the only part of the story that is even remotely true is the character of Peter, who is her crappy ex-boyfriend who comes back, gets back with her, and then reveals that he is living in sin with his cleaning lady. After surviving that relationship in real life, I wrote a therapeutic tome, which was called The Naked Tango, sent it to my previous publisher, who liked it very much, gave me an editor. And no one told me that the editor moonlighted as a writer of Harlequin romances. And this is, you know, as you know from having looked at it, there's quite a lot of sex and romance in it. That manuscript came back with the word penis 17 times added.
Added.
So I went into anaphylactic shock for a year. I was so horrified. I mean, I have nothing against it. In fact, I started off writing softcore porn for, you know, the Penthouse when I first started writing. So, but that's not the kind of book it is. It's a book about something in particular. It's about a woman who self-realizes and so on and so forth. So I took it back from my publisher. I licked my wounds, and then what came out of it is Bad Girl Pie. So I rewrote it, took 2 years, and then I'm published by John Hunt, which is now Collective Inc. So interestingly, we're having this conversation. Both this and my previous book, Word of the Day, How to Transform Your Writing in 15 Minutes a Day, are both published under that company. So clearly, English people in England like me. So just as an aside. And so Bad Girl Pie, they read it. They loved it. They loved it in part because I'm a professional story person. So their editing load was very light. It's autobiographical in the sense that I think that personally I was saved by Tango, because I've been through a very nasty divorce. And that was my second one. And I had a dream in which my grandfather, who used to dance the mambo, appeared. And he said, Marilyn, you have to go and dance the mambo. So I started off at the ballroom, and then I discovered tango. And I'm still, you know, a passionate tango dancer today.
Amazing.
And it solved the problem because, you know, there's all this, there's so much confusion in the world about, you know, what men's and women's roles are, right? But in tango, if you've read the book, you'll see there's a leader and a follower. It doesn't necessarily have to be a man or a woman. But the idea that you have these codified roles and that the interaction is quite subtle. It's not like ballroom where you're going 1, 2, 3, 4 and you're Ginger Rogers dancing backwards. In tango, both of you are improvising. And one of you is making the suggestion, which is the leader. And the dynamics of partnership and how you relate. I mean, all the problems I had in my love life became apparent after a couple of years of tango lessons, I'll tell you.
Amazing. So it was fun weaving that into the story then.
Well, I was proud that I had actually had some, I mean, the ultimate compliment was that my tango teacher called me after reading the book and said, you know, how did you know that I teach like this? So, you know, I felt like I really, I mean, that doesn't mean I can dance that well, but it means that I listen. I was very excited. Now, the whole plot and the story, I have a very colorful life and I have a lot of very mystical experiences. So I took a few of them, like her having the dream in which her father appears and says, if you don't write your own book, you will become a ghost. That's based on a different story, but a real dream that I had. So, you know, like all writers, what else do you have to work with? You got to work with what's to hand, right?
Yeah.
But the idea that it's the synthesis. What makes you a writer at all is your ability to equate metaphor with reality, right?
Mm. And what about the role of food in the book, particularly dessert and pies?
Well, obviously, I just told you my other, before I became a screenwriting expert, I was a professional cook because I can't type. I come from a fancy white collar family and they had despaired about me. So I cooked. I love food. And Dorothy just, you know, as I say, as she emerged, and I always feel that I receive my characters now. You know, I don't make them up. They sort of come to me and say, come on, I'm talking to you. You know, get that paper out. The idea is that what's great about, what I like about the book is that it has sex, it has tango, it has recipes, right? And the recipes are good, by the way. A lot of my, I tested them out before I put them in the book, but I get emails all the time saying, you know, that worked out really well. That flan was delicious.
Oh, good.
And then the diet book, this is, you know, Dorothy, this is again, an homage to my friend, always struggled with her weight. You know, when I was in college, I gained a little weight myself, but I cured it just the way I did in this book, which is that I discovered that if I woke up and had half a chocolate bar, I never overate. And I recommend that, by the way, anybody you know who's heavy.
Really?
Yeah, it's a miraculous thing. Yeah, I'm hoping that someone will ask me to actually do a book because there's a lot of neuroscience. But seriously, if you, you know, are feeling, even if you're not overweight, if you feel fat, you know, which I do sometimes too, I use this thing called a Kind Bar and I'm not getting any money from them. It's an American thing that has a low glycemic footprint, so it tastes like a candy bar, but it doesn't tweak your insulin. At a certain point in my life, I discovered that if I had a half of a protein bar or a protein bar, something sweet, and a cup of coffee, and then I remembered to eat during the day, I never gained or lost weight. And so when it came time to Dorothy, you know, I thought, well, it's perfect for her. And in my private practice, you know, as a writing coach, you're also a life coach because half of what you have to do is help people organize their lives and their finances so they can afford how long it takes to write a book or a screenplay and the market and so on and so forth. And so I probably helped of my students, I'd say 25% of them, I've helped them lose between 10 and 50 pounds, not by dieting.
Gosh, that's amazing. Multi-talented you are.
Oh, well, thank you. I just feel like, you know, again, I come from, you know, just, my father's side of the family were all bankers and lawyers. My mother was a philosophy professor. And between the two of them, nothing ever got done. And I just thought when I was a kid, you know, how come I'm reading all these books about thinking, but no one ever does anything? You know, so I wanted to be a person who could get in there and put in the missing link. And that's my new book, The Word of the Day, which I'd be happy to come and talk to you about another time. It's the same thing. It provides the missing link between trying to, you know, employ self-development and journaling techniques for effectiveness and actually making that happen, because I've added an element that was missing, which is a somatic connection where you have to physically connect with yourself. Which people find mind-blowing. And I'm, you know, just developing it, so on and so forth.
Yeah, amazing. Well, if people want to check that book out as well, that's The Word of the Day Practice, Transform Your Writing in 15 Minutes a Day. And if people want to get a copy of the new novel, it's available on our website, tre.radio. It's called Bad Girl Pie, and it's by Marilyn Horowitz, who we've been chatting with today. Marilyn, thank you so much for joining us. Great to chat with you.
Sure. Am I allowed to just say that I also, because of the new technique, I give a free biweekly webinar, and you can find it on my website, which is marilynhorowitz.com. And there I demonstrate the practice. We have a core group of about 15 amazing people, and I'm always eager to share this. As I say, there's no fee for it. It's my noblesse oblige, if you like. It's, you know, my gratitude for all that I've been receiving.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much, Marilyn.
Thank you so much for having me on, Hannah. I really appreciate that. Have a beautiful day.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Kristin Lush, who holds a BA in History as well as a Master's degree in Slavonic Studies from the University of Cambridge. Her debut historical novel, The Porcelain Doll, was shortlisted for the Caledonia Novel Award and was a finalist for the Edgar Award. She's with us on the book show to talk about her new novel, The Hong Kong Widow. It's a haunting gothic thriller perfect for Halloween. Welcome to the book show, Kristin.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And I understand this book, one of the early sources of inspiration, came from some award-winning flash fiction that you wrote in 2021.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. I wrote a 200-word story back in 2021. It is a single sentence long. And I wrote it for an online journal called Flashback Fiction, which is sadly now no longer printing stories. But at the time, I was experimenting a lot with short fiction, and I was interested in Hong Kong. And so I wrote this 200-word story about a girl named May who arrives in Hong Kong from China. She just kind of swims across the South China Sea. And that's all that happens in the story. But I kind of knew that I wanted to do more with her. Like, I wanted her to have more of a backstory. I wanted to learn more about her. I wanted to kind of figure out what was going on with her as a character. And I think that was always in the back of my mind as I started to shape my second novel and decided that she was going to star in it.
Yeah. And why did you decide to blend kind of historical with horror?
Well, the simple answer is that historical horror is one of my favorite genres. So a lot of the authors that I recently have read and adored, like Laura Purcell, for example, C.J. Cook. I could probably think of 10 others if I tried, but I won't bore you with a long list. But I do really enjoy that genre, and I really enjoy genre mixes, I think. And I also think in this particular case that I wanted to explore the idea, you know, trauma and memories and the ghosts that the character was kind of having with her. And so I wanted to make that both subtle and overt. And I felt like horror was a great, great way to explore that.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about May and what happens to her in this book.
Sure. So we see May at three different points in her life in this novel. So in one timeline, she is a young child in Shanghai, growing up at the time of the Japanese invasion of China in the 1930s. In another storyline, she is in Hong Kong in the 1950s as a young woman, and she enters a seance competition, the events of which eventually become urban legend. And in a third timeline, she is in 2015. She's an elderly grandmother, and she decides to investigate what really happened on the final night of that competition.
Ooh, interesting. And how is she entering the competition? What does she do?
Oh, great question. She receives a letter. So she's working as an artist in Hong Kong. This is sort of 20-something-year-old May. And she's a refugee of the Communist Revolution in China in 1953. And she's kind of struggling to get by, but making ends meet working in an antiques shop. And she gets a letter from a former silent film star whose name is Holly Zhang. And Holly Zhang lives in a colonial mansion up on Victoria Peak, which if anyone knows Hong Kong, then they know Victoria Peak is kind of the mountain that dominates Hong Kong Island and sort of looms over everything. And at that time, and to a certain extent still to this day, it is one of the wealthiest and more exclusive neighborhoods of Hong Kong. And Holly Zhang, this former Shanghainese silent film actress, lives up there on the peak, and she invites May to the house for a competition that will last 6 nights, pitting May against 5 other spirit mediums, 6 in total, and to see which one will emerge victorious.
Wow, interesting. So do you know a bit about mediumship, or did you have to do a bit of research for the book?
I did do a bit of research for the book, and that was because I wanted to bring in things that I knew, sort of that maybe are common knowledge to readers in America or in the UK, and combine that with things that they might not know about mediumship and spiritualism in China. And there are certain commonalities. There's definitely common ground there, but there are cultural aspects that I felt like, in order to really make it as powerful and meaningful a story as I could, I really needed to bring that element in. So I did do a lot of very fun and at times somewhat unsettling research and reading into that. And I remember there is a memoir that I read about a woman whose mother, I think, grew up in Shanghai, and she's kind of relaying her experiences and her mother's. And in this memoir, she describes a seance that they had at the house when she was a child. And I loved reading about that in that memoir, because I thought, oh my gosh, this is great. This actually, this really happened. They had this seance in this woman's house when she was a kid and her mother was there. And I thought, this is a great source of knowledge and inspiration. So there were quite a few times when I came across little tidbits like that that I was able to use and incorporate.
Yeah. So have you taken part in a seance yourself?
Oh gosh, no. I'm such a wimp. I would never be able to. Even thinking about it, I can't. I love reading horror. I can't watch horror movies. I love reading horror and I love reading about these things. But when it comes to actually doing them, I absolutely cannot. Just like there is a colonial mansion on Victoria Peak that I partially based my, the colonial mansion in my novel on. So this real life house is right there for anyone to sort of walk by. And I think a lot of urban explorers and people who don't mind jumping fences have actually sort of gone into the house to explore. It's abandoned. It's very, very creepy. And I lived in Hong Kong and I could never actually get that close to that house.
And in the book, you also combine sort of different types of horror and different genres. You've got classic Gothic, also Chinese folklore and urban legends as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I love Gothic horror. I love Gothic literature of all kinds, especially short stories. And I'm thinking of stories like the Yellow Wallpaper, for example, or The Lottery by Shirley Jackson, these sort of classic Gothic short stories that I really, really like. And I prefer Gothic horror in the sense that I prefer atmospheric horror to the more, maybe more visceral, more, gorier, bloodier type horror, if that makes sense. So I really like a sort of, eerie atmosphere and, I guess, secrets and, dark family histories and spookiness and ghosts, but without anything too disgusting or in your face, I suppose. So not to throw shade on anyone who does enjoy that, because definitely I know people who love that kind of horror and that's wonderful for them, but it's just not for me. So I think I wanted to go down, so the Gothic horror route with Hong Kong Widow. And then Chinese folklore and Chinese ghost lore is just so incredible. I mean, there's no way for me to, for anyone to do justice to even a fragment of that, that sort of body of work in one novel. But it was very fun to look through that treasure trove because they just, you know, so many ideas, there's so many types of ghosts in Chinese ghost lore. It's just every kind of possible death that you can imagine, as grim as that sounds. It ends up, it kind of creates a different kind of ghost, which I think is really interesting. But definitely I drew from certain elements of Chinese folklore. And there was this one short story called The Painted Skin. Oh gosh, I don't remember who it's by, but it's from the 1700s. And that is about a demon who sort of wears the body of a beautiful young woman. And I really enjoyed that story and thought, okay, I have to sort of maybe slightly work this in a little.
Amazing. And what is it that made you write this as a full-length novel as opposed to a short story?
Great question. So I have written quite a few short stories. I went through a period of writing a lot of short fiction, flash fiction, and short stories. But novel writing is definitely my sort of truest love, I would say. You know, I started out not knowing anything about writing short fiction, and I wrote my novel draft, and I wrote the first of many versions that would become my debut novel. And it was while I was in the process of revising my debut novel that I started to turn to short fiction. So my first agent had my debut with her, and she was, you know, sort of reading over it and working on it. And I was there twiddling my thumbs, kind of not knowing what to do with myself. And I turned to short fiction as a creative outlet to do something a bit different. But it was in the process of writing short fiction, of writing short stories, that I realized that I prefer in the end to write novels, that novels, something about exploring a character and a setting and a place and a story and narrative, maybe several narratives over the course of a full-length book, is fundamentally different to what you get from a short story in a way that really, really appeals to me as a writer. Although I read across a variety of, I guess, lengths of books, I still do. I love novel, full length novels the most. And I knew that, especially for May, given my fascination with her potential backstory and my need to sort of flesh her out and see both what had happened to her in her past and what was going to happen to her next, I knew that I needed that space to explore that.
And writing from the point of a child in the first part, was that difficult, getting into the mind of a child?
Oh yes, that was very, very, that was interesting. So it definitely presented some challenges, but once I decided that I was going to do it, I think that took a bit of a load off. So it felt very daunting at the beginning, and I've read some books that are written in a child's point of view perspective that have been incredible. And you just think that's kind of one of the most powerful tools that a writer even has at their disposal is this. I'm thinking of the novel Room by Emma Donoghue.
Oh yes. Amazing.
And that, I think, I can't remember exactly how old the little boy is at the beginning of the novel, but it's just stunning how she does it. It's really incredible. And I knew, okay, this is going to be tough. But I always want, and I think this was something that I discovered about myself while writing short fiction, is that I always want that challenge. I always want to sort of live on the knife edge of my abilities as a writer. Sometimes maybe overextend myself. It can't be helped, but I want to try. And the thing is that once I started writing in May's perspective, and I knew that I wanted her to have a sense of humor, I wanted her to, you know, still have that childish innocence about her, even though she's going through a lot of things personally. And even though she's living in a time, you know, against this historical backdrop of Japan invading China and lots of turmoil, you know, just a very tumultuous period of history. But I wanted her to have that way of looking at the world that is sort of universal to children at that age. And that was really, really important to me. And as I started writing her, something happened that made it flow probably easier than any character perspective ever has. And I don't know why that is. This as with many things about writing, there's something magical in the actual process that occurs that is both wonderful and completely inexplicable. And I adored writing her. And I would say that the greater challenge, ironically and interestingly, would have been the 1950s version of May, the version of May that is a young woman and enters the seance competition and is living in Hong Kong, you know, in 1953. That turned out to be much tougher.
Was that because of the research that you wanted to do into that time period, or why was that tougher?
I think it was because of who May is at that point. So when we meet May as a child, you know, she still is innocent and she hasn't been through the kind of horrific loss and trauma that May as a 20-something year old has gone through. So May in 1953 is a character that I knew was in a lot of pain. And this pain clouded everything, her judgment, her self-awareness, her view of the world. Everything was done sort of through this haze of pain. And that made her a difficult character to write in many ways because she was so disconnected from herself. And so writers will realize, obviously, as they read the book, that she's written in the third person, whereas May as a young girl and May as a grandmother are both written in the first person. And I kind of did that deliberately because it felt like May doesn't quite know who she is when she's 20-something in 1953. And part of her arc is realizing that she is more than just her own trauma and more than just the things that have happened to her. But I think that was probably the main reason.
Yeah, interesting. And is May the Hong Kong widow, or is that giving too much away?
Ooh. I cannot comment on that.
Okay.
But I am definitely open to readers contacting me and letting me know who they think the Hong Kong widow is.
Okay, interesting. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Hong Kong Widow, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Kristin Lush, who we've been chatting with today. Kristin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Hannah.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts, and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.